Good evening, folks, and welcome to our continuing conversations on colonial and revolutionary America, a series sponsored by the Institute for Southern Studies and the College of Arts and Sciences. Our speaker tonight is Woody Holton, the McCausland Professor of History at the University. He did his undergraduate work at UVA, got his PhD from Duke, from my old friend Peter Wood, and he has a number of publications: Forced Founders, Indians, Debtors, Slaves, and the Making of the American Revolution in Virginia, which won the Merle Curdy Award from the Organization of American Historians as the best book on American history for 1999. Unruly Americans in the Constitution, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Black Americans in the Revolutionary Era, and most recently, Abigail Adams, which won the Bancroft Prize as the best book in American history from the American Historical Association.
Thanks, Walter.
And we're going to talk tonight about the British made us do it. I guess that's what I'm going to say. About imperial policies, because as we talked about with Dan Tortora, the dysfunction that happened to South Carolina society on the frontier produced a generation of revolutionary leaders on the frontier, but it also led to social instability in South Carolina and conflict with Great Britain over a number of policies. So let's just pick up there with the war ends in 1763, the French and Indian War, the Great War for the Empire, whatever you want to call it.
Can I say first, Walter, that I think you've asked the right question, and people don't always ask the right question because they ask, why did the colonists rebel? You were joking when you said the British made us do it, but that's literally true, that if you ask the average free colonist in South Carolina in, say, 1763, how do you feel about the king? They'd say the same thing George Washington said, which was, he's the best of kings. They were perfectly satisfied. I mean, they were rough around the edges, and some of the issues you talked about with Dan Tortora go to this, but in general, the colonists were pretty satisfied with that relationship with Britain in 1763. The dissatisfaction was in Parliament. And there were good reasons for that dissatisfaction. For instance, all these New Englanders who had traded with the enemy during the French and Indian War, and for instance, the huge cost of maintaining the empire that the colonists bore, at least from the British perspective, none of. The colonists had their own view about that.
They didn't keep very good books on that, though, did they, in terms of the expenses? I mean, just for example, they kept saying South Carolina didn't do its share in funding for the French and Indian War because, of course, there was that contention between the governor and Governor Boone and about the Gadsden. But yet South Carolina spent over $850,000 in today's money and had the highest per capita debt of any colony, but that was never appreciated in London.
Well, and they got the least reimbursement, right, because relative to what they'd put in, and that's because the British figured their reimbursement based on how many soldiers you sent to the north, basically the northern theater of the war. And South Carolina didn't send that many. It couldn't, because it was busy fighting the Indians in its own back country, the Cherokees, from 1759 to 61. And also white South Carolinians were worried about the fact that they were, as they were for almost the entire colonial era, a minority, and they had to keep soldiers around to protect them from their own slaves.
Yep. In fact, the demographics from about 1720 on, it's roughly a 2-to-1 black majority, particularly in the low country. Now, once those folks start coming down the Great Wagon Road from Pennsylvania and the Shenandoah Valley, that begins to change, but still, you know, it is a black majority, as your mentor, Peter Wood, said.
Yes, right up to the Revolution, and that's going to affect everything.
All right, so we've got this big empire, and let's go back to London now.
Yes.
And Parliament and the Board of Trade, and we'll get back to George. He's an easy figure to go against. He was nuts, but that's...
He was nuts, and I would argue, you might disagree with me on this one, Walter, but I would argue that not only was George III nuts, he, by that time, was a figurehead, closer to the modern monarchs of Britain. She doesn't write her speech that she gives to Parliament. Elizabeth II doesn't. Neither did George III. His speech was written for him by the leaders of Parliament. So the Declaration of Independence is all about George III, but really it's directed against Parliament. They say, in the Continental Congress says in the Declaration of Independence, George III has combined with others. Well, we all know who those others were. It's Parliament. So your question is, why was Parliament dissatisfied with the relationship with the colonists in 1763? And people in this audience won't be surprised by the answer. It had something to do with a government that was hugely in debt, and it didn't want to go deeper in debt. Now, it's a myth, though, that, for instance, the Stamp Act was trying to get money out of the colonists to pay off the British debt. The Stamp Act, I actually just published an article last year called The Indians and the Stamp Act, because there's a sense in which the Stamp Act is there because the Indians were there. And my point about that is the reason that Parliament adopted the Stamp Act, the first of those really serious taxes in 1765, was to pay for 10,000 British soldiers, redcoats, that Parliament decided to leave in the colonies after the French and Indian War.
Now, that was an issue in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Having those soldiers is going to lead to a quartering controversy in South Carolina as well as in New York and Massachusetts. But you got to pay for them. And the British, having just run up this huge debt, we're not going to pay for these soldiers. We're gonna make the colonists pay for them. But I say no Indians, no Stamp Act, because where are most of those soldiers being placed out on the frontier to keep the Indians away from the colonists and the colonists away from the Indians?
Okay, and speaking of Indians, you've got the famous proclamation line of 1763, which says that there'll be a dividing line between where settlements permitted and Indian territory. Usually the Appalachians are considered the dividing line.
Right.
And that was a big issue in places like your home state of Virginia, where these people already had land speculators, had gone over the mountains, North Carolina. It was not really an issue in South Carolina because, remember, folks, Greenville, Anderson, and Oconee, that's still Indian territory. And so the only people on the frontier were those Scots-Irish, and the people in Charleston didn't care about the Scots-Irish on the frontier. There was no land speculation there. There was plenty of land, even in this area, the Midlands of South Carolina, for land speculators to get involved with.
That's right. So I would agree with you. Say this in the history that the proclamation line was a much less serious grievance in South Carolina than it was in other places like Virginia, and I completely agree with that. I mean, right where Clemson is now was a Seneca town, still there in as late as 1776, even.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing they did after Parliament. Board of Trade, and the Board of Trade is the official body that's dealing with the colonies. That's the bureaucracy that's dealing with the colonies. They decided we can't let the colonies manage their Indian affairs. Well, South Carolina had managed her Indian affairs since 1670. So now, after almost 100 years, these folks from London are going to say, well, you don't know what you're doing, so we're going to organize and we're going to take charge. And they create Superintendent of Indian Affairs for the northern colonies and the southern colonies. Well, they did appoint a South Carolinian, John Stewart, of Charleston, to be the Superintendent of Indian Affairs for the southern colonies. There was some resentment, but at the same time there was relief because all of a sudden now the Commons House doesn't have to pay for the treaties with the Indians. They don't have to pay for the arms and the ammunition and the trade goods. This now has gotten to be an imperial issue, but then that's more money that the king's got to have.
There, I do think there's a couple of issues with John Stewart. One is William Henry Drayton gets really mad at John Stewart because John Stewart nixed a deal that when William Henry Drayton was trying to negotiate with the Catawba Indians. Just about anybody you can name who's a leader of the Revolution, including Washington and Jefferson, Ben Franklin, are land speculators. That's their major source of wealth. That and marrying rich widows. but Drayton had a deal going with the Catawbas, right? And John Stewart nixed that. The other thing I'd say about John Stewart comes much later in 1775. He actually has to escape South Carolina and runs first to Georgia and then to the British colony of Florida because he's afraid, basically. I think it's a little bit unfair to his fellow colonists, but he thinks they're going to lynch him. And the reason is that they think that John Stewart, who is the British Indian agent in touch with the Cherokees and the other Indians, that he has been trying to stir them up to attack white South Carolinians.
He might not have in 1775, but he certainly did later.
He later did, absolutely, yes. Well, although the funny thing is, you know, when the Cherokees do attack, this is past where we want to go today, but when the Cherokees did attack in 1776, John Stewart and his fellow agents were saying, "We're not ready for you to attack yet. We want you to attack, just not yet." And the Cherokees are humans, and they make their own decision about when to attack. But the colonists thought, aha, the Cherokees are attacking us. It's probably the British doing it. And that becomes one of their grievances, one of their reasons to declare independence. That he has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages from the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. So you look at the chronology of events from 1763 to 1775, and particularly in South Carolina, and it just seems like almost every year, literally, the British government is making a misstep that does something to tick off a segment of South Carolina society, not always the same ones, but, you know, for example, the Sugar Act. And talk to the folks about the Sugar Act for a minute, what it did.
Well, there were, as you know, but the audience may not know, there are actually aspects of the Sugar Act that helped South Carolina. They gave South Carolina a monopoly of the British market of indigo. They already had a bounty, thanks, on indigo, and now they're going to also have a monopoly of the British market. But in other colonies, the so-called Sugar Act was really the end of the line, because people forget, you think of the slave colonies in the South and the free colonies in the North. Not true. There were slaves in all 13 of the colonies that rebelled. But more to the point is, these northern colonies like Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania were entirely dependent on slavery in the Caribbean, because they are buying molasses and sugar and rum from the Caribbean, and they're selling Pennsylvania grain, Massachusetts fish, Connecticut livestock to the Caribbean. But here's where the Sugar Act comes in. A lot of that buying and selling from the northern colonies is to French islands in the Caribbean and Spanish islands. Those are the enemy.
I was going to say, yeah, the enemy.
And so the Sugar Act does a lot of things, but one of the things it does is really crack down on that smuggling that those colonists were doing. And so it really, really makes them
And there were some import duties on some wines and That kind of thing.
But Madeira, you don't want to mess with the Madeira.
But you know, the people, yeah, but the people who were buying Madeira in Charleston, it didn't make any difference. I mean, that was not a tax that bothered them. What really got to them, literally in the pocketbook, was the Currency Act the next year in 1764.
Yeah, I was worried about getting ready for tonight. How far can we go into money supply before everybody nods off? But it really was absolutely crucial. You've got a developing economy that's borrowing money to further development, to buy that land, to buy slaves from slave traders like Henry Lawrence, although he's out of the business by this time. A developing economy has a chronic trade deficit. It means that you don't have much money in circulation. And so all of the colonies at various times had tried to print paper money, but two laws that Parliament passed in 1751, not applying to South Carolina, but then 1764 applying to South Carolina, just shut that down. And the reason it was shut down was that British merchants who had lent money to, say, people in South Carolina didn't want to be paid back with paper money. They wanted gold and silver, or at least these bills of exchange, which are like gold and silver. And so this is a sense, Walter, in which I'd say the American Revolution is kind of a class conflict. And that is because the British merchants really had power over the British Parliament and could get laws like the Currency Act passed, even though that it really harmed South Carolinians, I think.
Well, it did, and there are a couple of things, and I don't want to contradict a guest, but South Carolina had
Please do. They need to know that arguing is what we enjoy doing.
South Carolina had a favorable balance of trade with the mother country from 1708 on, the only colony that did. Now, yes, there was a lot of investment, but the South Carolina currency floated at roughly, it really didn't float much, it pretty much stayed at a 7-to-1 ratio throughout the colonial period. In other words, it was a stable currency. You can read, whether it's Robert Pringle or Henry Lawrence, in every letter they talk about the current rate of exchange is, and it was recognized in London. It was the other colonies like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and New York that printed this worthless stuff. But what happened is the Currency Act said you don't have to accept colonial currency for debts.
Right.
It really caused, didn't necessarily a recession, but it certainly hurt South Carolina's economy in the 1760s. And it wasn't just the merchants. Who's borrowing the money? It's the planters. So it's hitting two groups. And then who's not buying the artisans' wares in Charleston? So the artisans are getting, so it's really hitting a little bit of everybody.
Absolutely.
But that's just the prelude to the Stamp Act, and I can't wait to get into the Stamp Act. So I'll let you explain it, and then we'll talk about it in Charleston and in London.
You could see the British perspective on the Stamp Act. I mean, you can really understand their side of it. There was already a Stamp Act in Britain. That is, people who filed legal documents or bought playing cards, which are wrapped in paper, all these other newspapers and so forth, they already were paying a stamp tax there. And so the British government, having made this decision to leave these 10,000 redcoat soldiers to protect the colonists, is the way they viewed it, in America after the French and Indian War, okay, if we're going to have these 200,000 soldiers in America, the Americans should pay for it. And since we have a Stamp Act in force here, why not have one for the colonists as well? So it's easy to see their side of it, but of course the colonist side of that is, if you can levy a tax on stamps, you can levy a tax on our houses, on our noses, and everything else about us, because we're not represented in Parliament. There's nothing we can do about it. I'm a little embarrassed to say this with my former dean here, but I'll tell you the trick I use with my students on this. I've got this huge survey class, 270 students, and on when I'm talking about this issue, I put up a slide on the start of class saying, $1.67. I need every student to turn in $1.67 to pay for some printed materials that I'm going to be handing out later. So just bring a dollar. And they're all going, we're already paying tuition. And why are you going to? It's the point is not that $1.67 is a lot of money. It's the principle of the thing. My point with doing that was to, I do reveal by the end of the class, just I don't really need the $1.67, although some of them still bring it up anyway. it's not the amount of money. It's the principle. Because once you let them charge this much, then they can charge more, which they did intend to do.
Well, you mentioned the legal documents and playing cards, dice, pamphlets. We got into pamphlets last time a little bit with the Cherokee War and the conflicts between Middleton and Lawrence and Colonel Grant and what have you. Publishing sermons was a big deal in 18th century Charleston. So you hit the clergy of all denominations.
Right.
You hit the lawyers. A deed. You want to file a deed? We still have to pay, we still have tax stamps on our deeds, but hey, that's our inheritance. But you don't often think of it hitting the blacksmith or the silversmith or the cabinet maker, but if he wanted to have an apprenticeship, get someone as an apprentice, he had to file a document. It was equivalent in today's money of about a half of a week's of his week's earnings, the stamp. It might be a nuisance to Henry Lawrence, but it was a real economic issue to the men who would become Charleston's Sons of Liberty.
Right, right.
And so when Christopher Gadsden, and I know you've looked into him and the formation of the Charleston Sons of Liberty, the Stamp Act was exactly the gasoline that he was looking for.
Absolutely. As you said before, it is almost like if someone had sat down in 1763 in London and said, how can we systematically make everybody mad? that they did that. And the Stamp Act almost got everybody just with that one piece of legislation. So opposition to it was nearly universal. And they basically nullified it. You can't operate a court without stamped papers. And so, basically the court ceased to meet.
Everything closed down, commerce, because you couldn't clear port without a customs papers. So that had to have stamps. So everything was shut down. Well, South Carolinian, well, first of all, they kept the stamps from coming on shore. There were mobs in the streets. In fact, Lieutenant Governor Bull had them put over at Fort Johnson so they wouldn't actually come into town and be destroyed. And remember, at this time, the exchange building actually was on the waterfront. And that was the grand entrance to Charleston, just like the railroad stations in the 20th century were the grand entrances. And these people rode over from Fort Johnson, who had been the stamp collectors that came in, and they had liberty and no stamps. They were cheered because they said they weren't going to be the stamp collectors. Now, there was a rumor that Henry Lawrence was going to be one of the stamp collectors. And so a mob invaded his house, and as he wrote in his letters, actually looked under the bed of Ella. His wife Eleanor was pregnant, as he said, once in the round of a 12-month, which was normal for their marriage. Yeah. Looked under her bed for the stamps, and he was convinced that Christopher Gadsden was one of the people who actually looked under the bed. Well, the courts were closed down, but Lieutenant Governor Bull had appointed several associate justices for the court, and there was a case filed in South Carolina court, Jordan versus Law, to challenge the legitimacy of the Stamp Act based upon the Magna Carta, which says the king's justice may not be halted or delayed for any reason. And they actually ruled, the South Carolina courts ruling, that an act of parliament is unconstitutional because of that. Eventually there's relenting, and they do now have a new royal governor. They've got to let the ships out, they do, and because the Americans decided to boycott British goods, and it worked. So those merchants that Woody talked about was so powerful, all of a sudden, nobody was buying but British goods. There is a Stamp Act Congress, the first intercolonial gathering in protest, and South Carolina sends delegates to the Stamp Act Congress, which passes a lot of resolutions. Congresses do that resolution, this resolution, you know, whatever. But South Carolina had its own legislature, the Commons House of Assembly, which was actually a pretty radical body, and it passed a series of resolutions condemning practices of Great Britain. One, the Currency Act, another, a multiple office holding where a colonial official could hold one or two or three offices, and we'll find out where that comes into a problem shortly. But they also passed a resolution which contained the following phrase: in taxing ourselves and making laws for our own internal government, we can by no means allow our provincial legislature to be subordinate to any legislative power on earth. Now, folks, that is a revolutionary statement. They were thumbing their nose at Parliament. And this astonished a lot of folks. And it passed with only one dissenting vote. Now, the Stamp Act, of course, gets repealed. And I'll let you go back to Parliament.
But unfortunately, on the same day that Parliament repealed the Stamp Act, it also adopted another law called the Declaratory Act, saying the opposite of what the Commons had said, which was that Parliament has the power to legislate for the colonies, quote, in all cases whatsoever. So even though we are pulling back the Stamp Act because it's hurt us commercially, we still claim the right. There are no exceptions. We have the power to legislate for the colonists. And so anybody who'd been paying attention would have seen really that the issue was joined. Who has the final authority over Pennsylvania? Is it the Pennsylvania Assembly or is it Parliament? And likewise in South Carolina, who is the legislature? Is it the one that sits in London or is it the one that sits in Charleston? People couldn't imagine what we can imagine now, the Federalist system, where there's authority split between Washington, D.C., and Columbia. That they called that imperium in imperio, a kingdom within a kingdom, and they just couldn't imagine it.
Well, and it's interesting because everybody was so excited when the news came of the repeal of the Stamp Act, they just didn't pay any attention to the Declaratory Act.
Right.
No, the first one got their attention. The Stamp Act was repealed, and so our Commons House was so excited that they purchased a statue of William Pitt, and it cost $123,000. In today's money. The backcountry said, we need roads, we need schools, we need courthouses. Now, I'm quoting now, folks. I'm not making this up.
And it's one of the grievances of the regulators,
one of the grievances of the regulator movement. And you're buying a statue?
Yeah.
Which for many years was at the intersection of Broad and Meeting Streets. Well, those folks in London, Woody, couldn't leave well enough alone. They come up with the Townshend duties.
See, I think there's a logic to the Stamp Act. The British government had put those troops there. They had to pay for them. But the Townshend duties just make no sense. Charles Townshend, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, had this idea that we in London are going to take over the payment of the salaries of certain crucial governors and Supreme Court justices and so forth, even some attorney generals in some cases, out in the colony. So we're going to pay their salaries in order to make them more beholden to us. And in order to come up with the money to pay their salaries, we will levy a tax on lead and painters' colors and glass, and most famously, tea. And that was in 1767. The amount, to, even if the thing had completely worked, the maximum amount that even Townsend himself thought it would raise was 50,000 pounds a year from all of the 13 colonies together, which was not a huge amount. I think the Townsend duties, the only way you can make it make sense is as a cat's paw. That is, if we can get this little amount and establish a precedent that Parliament has the right to tax the colonists, then we can ask for a lot more later.
Well, this is a pretty natural follow-up to the Declaratory Act.
Right, right. It's a way of asserting the right that had merely been expressed with words in 1776.
And it's likely that this idea of paying government officials, not that they necessarily cite South Carolina, but most of the royal officials in South Carolina, their salaries were paid by the Commons House. And the governor himself received a stipend at the end of every year from the Commons House in addition to his salary. So this had royal officials in many colonies careful about how they tread.
You would expect it to. And so you can see the logic of what Parliament did. But the reality is that most of the governors, as you know, were pretty tough, even though the legislature is paying their salary and maybe giving them a bonus at the end. You'd think they'd be completely beholden to the legislature, but up and down, there are battles between the governor and the legislature. So I guess my point, Walter, you might not agree, is it was unnecessary, the Townsend duties. It was solving a problem that really didn't exist, unless the real goal was that it's like the salesman getting his foot in the door.
Paying of these salaries came up time and again in the quarrels between the Commons House of Assembly and the Royal Council in South Carolina. But, you know, things just can't get quiet. And as I have said in my history and I told in my classes, we've got intercolonial things that are affecting folks, the Townshend duties, the Stamp Act, the Currency Act. But there are some local events that occur that really helped spur South Carolina on to revolution. And one of them is a controversy between Henry Lawrence and Sir Peter Lee, who was the chief judge of the Vice Admiralty Court, the Naval Court,
right,
and the Attorney General of South Carolina and a member of the council. Well, one of the things that Parliament and the Board of Trade wanted all of the governments in the colonies to do was to tighten up on customs officials. You talked about trading with French and Spanish colonies. Well, South Carolinians did that too. I mean, Cuba's not that far away, Haiti. And so to enforce the Navigation Acts, which had really been on the books since the 1690s, if you left one colony, you had to have a piece of paper signed by a customs official. If you came into a port, you had to have a piece of paper. Well, look at the seacoast of Georgia and South Carolina. If you've got people shipping produce from their plantations directly to Charleston, there's no customs official in Georgetown. There's no customs official on the Santee. There's no customs official down on the Altamaha in Georgia, which is where Henry Lawrence had a number of plantations. Well, Lawrence sent two of his ships from his Altamaha plantations they came into Charleston with shingles, wooden shingles. Well, they didn't have a customs piece of paper. I mean, Lawrence had shipped them from his place to himself. But they were seized by the customs officials as smuggled goods. And now begins a 2-year legal battle. It evolves into a pamphlet warfare as well.
Let me interject just one thing before you describe that battle. Understand that these customs officials were not just being hardworking. You know, we'd all like to see people in the civil service who worked as hard as those guys did. But there's a reason they work so hard, which is you seize a ship, it gets sold, you get a cut of the proceeds.
Yes, yes. And so does the Vice Admiralty judge.
Right, right.
So
that makes him nice and unbiased.
Yes, Lawrence had his ships seized. But under the Navigation Acts, he could sue. And so he sued the customs collectors in Charleston. Well, since they were royal officials, their defense attorney was the Attorney General, who was also the judge of the Vice Admiralty Court. All right, this is where you get to multiple office holding. Well, Peter Lee tried to figure out how he could work this. Lawrence was a very influential figure. At this point, still very loyal to the crown, very much a conservative in terms of relations. He kept referring to England as home, although he was a Huguenot, descended from a family that had been in New York and moved to Charleston. But he referred to Mother England. And so Lee tried to work out a deal. It didn't quite work out because the customs official, if he worked out a deal, he could be charged for money. And the end result was that this was an example not of royal authority but of royal tyranny. How could you get a fair trial if the defense attorney and the judge are the same man, the same royal official? Okay? And this was not uncommon. This is dual office holding, which was permitted under British law. And it was common back home, too. If you have more offices, you get more salary. And it just so happened that the Vice Admiralty Court was a very lucrative position. And it was also a chance for corruption. So anyway, this was a local issue that inflamed a lot of South Carolinians, not just Henry Lawrence, but other merchants. If it could happen to somebody like Lawrence, who is one of these guys who always, at this point, always toes the line. He doesn't pad his income tax, so to speak. He, you know, obeys. If they'll go after Lawrence, what about those of us who might sort of skirt, you know.
Say John Hancock, for instance.
Like John Hancock in Massachusetts, yeah. But that wasn't the only thing that got South Carolinians upset or gets Parliament upset in South Carolina. There was an English politician and a journalist by the name of John Wilkes. And you want to tell them who John Wilkes was?
A scoundrel, by most people's estimations, and a bit of a drinker and a ladies' man, all sorts of other things. But he got into a battle. He got elected to Parliament. And because of some of the things he'd said and done, Parliament threw him out and wouldn't seat him, and actually threw him in jail as well. And so he becomes a martyr.
Yeah, you can't criticize the monarch in Parliament. That's still the parliamentary procedure.
And also he had published this North Britain number 45, a newspaper. Also, see, no one ever said the king's a jerk, but you can say that in so many words, and that's what he did. People knew what he was saying, and so. So again, it's one of these things where you can see their side. This is still the, as you say, it's still the case in Britain. It's still the case in Thailand, lots of places. You can't trash the monarch. And that's what he did, and that's what they put him in jail for it.
And somebody establishes a defense fund for
right.
him. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. There was a defense, I think it was something like the Fund for Defense of English Rights or something.
The Society for the Defense of Bill of Rights, Constitutional Bill of Rights, yeah.
Anyway, the Commons House of South Carolina decided that Mr. Wilkes was a martyr and he deserved to be supported. So in today's money, they sent $195,000 to the defense fund, which was 10% of the money collected to defend John Wilkes. Well, the Board of Trade and the parliamentary committees just went absolutely nuts. A colony is sending defense money to somebody that Parliament has put in jail for slandering the king.
Yeah.
And so the Board of Trade said to the royal governor, they can't do that. And the governor said to the Commons House, you can't do that. And they said, well, it's too bad. We've already sent the bills of exchange. The money's already there. What are you going to do about it? We're not going to undo it. Well, the Board of Trade then told the governor, you tell those people in the Commons House that they can no longer just appropriate money. The Royal Council will have to approve any appropriation before it becomes law. And the Commons House said, not going to happen. Beginning in 1769, ladies and gentlemen, royal government in South Carolina quickly, legally kind of disappears. And by 1771, you still have a governor, you still have royal officials, but there's no legislative action taken in South Carolina after 1771. And you've got extra legal bodies jumping up, Woody, all over the place.
Absolutely. And actually, they do. The legislature sometimes does things that are just not recognized by the governor and council. For instance, in spring of 1774, they've got all these people who have performed services for the province who need to be paid. And so they printed up these certificates and paid the public creditors with these certificates. completely not recognized by the governor and council as legal documents, but people did accept them because the legislature said you can pay these back in as your taxes. And what I like about that is it goes back to, we were talking about the Currency Act before, that's got this economy that's totally starved of circulating currency after the Currency Act. So you've got that controversy, now this controversy over the Wilkes Fund, and the legislature sees an opportunity to kill two birds with one stone, because they print up these certificates to pay off the public creditors, which the council wouldn't let them do, and then that money also becomes a circulating currency.
In reaction to government actions, all sorts of meetings, and they're too complicated. There's a general meeting and there's a special.
Right.
But these are gathering together of folks in Charleston, just initially of folks from the Lowcountry, but by 1775 it's going to include folks from all over South Carolina to basically protest British policy. And of course, this is going to really, by 1773, the Tea Act, and that's when things fast forward to revolution.
Absolutely. Parliament does the Tea Act. There are protests against that, not just in Boston. Go ahead.
Tell them what the Tea Act does.
Okay. So I love talking about this right now, because the Tea Act was a law passed by the national legislature to bail out a corporation that was too big to fail.
The East India Company.
The East India Company. And people were angry because that involved taxation on them, and so they did something called the Tea Party. So the East India Company had gotten into these expensive wars in India and was in a very weak negotiating position in Canton in China, where it got the tea, and it had lots of other problems, and so it was really bankrupt. And so as a way of bailing out the East India Company, Parliament allowed it to sell its tea directly in America. Which actually makes tea cheaper in America, but there's that cat's paw again, because the tea has had that tax on it ever since 1767. It's one of the Townsend duties. The others have been repealed, but the tea tax remains. And so what the Tea Act became was a way of luring Americans into acknowledging Parliament's right to tax them, because we're going to make British tea, it's all coming from China, but you call it British tea, so cheap, it's cheaper than the smuggled Dutch variety, and the thought was that they'll buy that. But of course, they famously threw it in the harbor in Boston. In Charleston,
We didn't really have a tea party. They put it in the exchange building, the basement of the exchange building, and then during the revolution sold it to buy arms and ammunition.
Oh, that's right, the colonists ended up with it, and so they made the profit, that's right.
But they also gave the East India Company a monopoly.
Right.
On the tea. So you've got a monopoly and a tax. What happens when Parliament finds out about the Tea Party in Boston?
Yeah, so the Boston Tea Party, I mean, there were various little versions of the Tea Party up and down. They, in Annapolis, Maryland, they made a guy burn his own ship to the water line and so forth. But the big one was Boston, and that leads Parliament to adopt they call them coercive acts over there, intolerable acts over here. It's the interesting thing about this, and it goes to an issue that you've talked about before, Walter, all of those so-called intolerable acts, unless you count the Quebec Act, all the others were directed only at Massachusetts. The Administration of Justice Act says that people accused of a crime,
British officials accused of a crime,
that's right, while breaking up a riot or whatever, have the choice of going home to be tried. So Americans call it the murdering bill, because it means if you're a British official, you can murder a colonist, and some jury back in London's going to find you innocent. Only applied to Massachusetts. There was a quartering act. And we should say, by the way, there were two quartering acts, but neither of them, even if they'd been fully enforced, ever would have put a British soldier in anyone's house.
But that's what everybody thought.
I think people thought it at the time. Certainly people think it now, and it shows up in that very popular part of the Bill of Rights today, the Third Amendment, the amendment that nobody thinks about. These intolerable acts of 1774, technically, they all applied only to Massachusetts.
Well, you've got the Massachusetts Government Act, which begins to restrict the town meetings, which are essential local government that's been going on in Massachusetts since 1620.
That's right. And they mess with the jury system there. The jurors had been chosen locally, and now they're going to be chosen by the county sheriff. All this stuff. But the fascinating thing to me is that all of this only applies to Massachusetts. So technically, South Carolina is untouched. Rhode Island, right next to Massachusetts is untouched by it. But people could see, as they put it over and over again, people use the same phrase, that Massachusetts is suffering in the common cause. And even though they had had all these colonial, intercolonial rivalries, you know, South Carolinians thought the New Englanders were crazy. They were the ones who'd hanged the witches, for instance.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that was mutual. But even though the coercive acts were only aimed at one colony, the other colonies rallied to the defense of Massachusetts.
And, of course, the other thing was, in Tyler Brack, you did not mention, was that the Port of Boston was closed until Massachusetts paid for the tea that was damaged.
Which was never going to happen.
Now, what Woody said is that South Carolinians, you read the South Carolina Gazette, the South Carolina Gazette and Country Journal, and the South Carolina American Gazette, we had three, but the last was a royalist paper, but two of the three would talk about if they can close the port of Boston, they can close the port of Charleston. If they can alter the charter of Massachusetts, they're going to alter ours. Look at what they're trying to do now by saying that the Commons House can't just pass any money bill anymore. It's got to be approved by the council as well. They're already messing with our charter. And the Quartering Act about soldiers is interesting because during the French and Indian War, South Carolina had actually built a barracks for soldiers, but it was full, and they were scared of, well, are we going to have redcoats in our house? They did during the Revolution, but that was
This is the irony of the Quartering Act, is that people, for many reasons, including the Quartering Act, went up against the British, even though the Quartering Act didn't quarter troops in people's houses, so they end up with a war against the British. And during the war, as you just said, both sides, American and British, did quarter troops in people's houses.
Yeah. All of these are going to end up appearing in some version, these actions by the British government, in the Declaration of Independence. Now, there's one, you already mentioned the unloosing the savages on the frontier.
Right.
There's one that's very peculiar to South Carolina, that is moving our seat of government to unusual places. The governor thought the council in 1771, 72 were at loggerheads, so he figures if he calls the Commons House to meet in Beaufort, that maybe the folks that are standing up against him won't be there. But that is the direct reference. South Carolina's, you know, he thought by moving the capital, he didn't actually move the capital itself, but he called the assembly to meet in Beaufort, away from Charleston, to try to influence how it would behave.
Right. Well, and another, if I can say it briefly, another uniquely Southern aspect of the Declaration of Independence is that capstone grievance. There's 28 complaints, but the final one, and actually by far the longest in Jefferson's rough draft, they reduced it in the final draft to, he has excited domestic insurrection amongst us. That's a euphemism, but what it means is it's an accusation by white colonists that the British government had formed an alliance with black colonists against them. And it had literally been done in Virginia. The governor there, Dunmore, issued an Emancipation Proclamation in November of 1775, saying that if you are a slave of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, and you'll come fight on my side, I'll reward you with your freedom. And in fact, both Jefferson and Washington had slaves who fought on the British side, as did Patrick Henry. Now, neither of the governors of South Carolina in 1775 did make that alliance, but they were accused of it, and more importantly, the London government was accused of it. So that in 1775, the Provincial Congress that met in Charleston created a military. We all know the real reason was to be prepared to fight the British if they had to. But when they listed their reasons, they listed the possibility of an Indian War, which was a real possibility. And they also used what I think is a really key phrase, the dread of instigated insurrection. By instigated, they mean the British are going to stir the slaves up against us. And the insurrection is a reference to that 60% of South Carolinians who were enslaved. And so I would go so far in Virginia, I bet it may not be the case in South Carolina, but in Virginia, I'd say if there had been no slaves, you would have had lots of protest, but maybe not a move to independence, because it so infuriated those slaveholders, the notion, as one man put it, of aiming a dagger at our throats through the hands of our slaves. That's what pushes somebody over from being a protester to being ready to declare independence.
Well, I would say in South Carolina, by this time, after the Lawrence Lee affair, Henry Lawrence is already looking down the road towards independence, and others as well, although South Carolina was not united in 1775. But let's talk about the events in 1775. You mentioned the Provincial Congress, which is the first true colony-wide in terms of South Carolina. The backcountry is asked to send delegates to this meeting. Of course, now it's apportioned. Now, you got to remember that two-thirds of the white population lives in the backcountry. One-third of the voting population lives in the low country. Well, the apportionment in the Provincial Congress is just the opposite. Two-thirds of the seats are in the low country. One-third of the seats are in the backcountry. And that's one of the reasons why the backcountry is really kind of lukewarm about this whole affair. We're not yet to the Declaration of Independence, but we're into 1775. The Provincial Congress, which eventually evolves into the first General Assembly, begins to really take hold of matters with the Council of Safety we've already talked about. There is bloodshed in the backcountry near 96. The famous snow campaign of 1775, I think you wanted to jump in on that.
Yeah, there was a historian way back in 1909 named Carl Becker, who you know, published a book called The History.
I only know the book.
Touché. The book was called History of Political Parties in the Province of New York, and he said that the American Revolution, as everybody knows, was a struggle for home rule, but it was also a struggle over who would rule at home. That is, once the British are out, who's going to come in place of them? And I think that's one of the most exciting themes about the Revolution is all of these internal conflicts that took place. You could start with Henry Lawrence's conflicts with Edgerton Lee and the customs officials, or his conflict earlier with Gadsden and so forth. But there are also these fundamental conflicts, A, between the free and the enslaved, B, between the colonists and the Indians, but also even among white colonists. There were, as you said, a lot of people in the backcountry who, a friend of mine has a great phrase for this. He says they fought to stay neutral. And I think there was that powerful group. But then there were also people who, in the same way that you and I are loyal to the United States, they were loyal to their king. And they might acknowledge that the course of acts were bad, the Stamp Act had been bad, and so forth. But their fundamental was to be loyal to their king. And so, yes, you get, in the summer of 1775, white South Carolinians shooting at other white South Carolinians over that issue.
The famous snow campaign in the winter, December of 1775, led by Richard Richardson, they tracked down the Tories. And it's called the snow campaign because it was so cold, the snow was on the ground, and they literally were able to track the Tories in the snow. I mean, it stayed on the ground. It never warmed up enough to melt the snow. At best, as we get into early 1776, most of the folks in the backcountry had pretty much agreed to, we're not going to oppose you, but we're not necessarily going to support you. And it's interesting, when the Lowcountry was trying to get these backcountry folks to go along, they sent William Henry Drayton back there, which I've often said I'm not sure how great a choice that was, because he tended to lecture people. You know, you go to the Dutch Fork and you start lecturing those Germans, and you go up to Thickety Ford or Spartan and start lecturing those Scots-Irish in the Presbyterian meeting house. It's not going to get very far. But they sent a Presbyterian clergyman and a Baptist clergyman along with him to try to make the case. But as we move into 1776, and we'll get into that next week, you know, Campbell has fled. He flees Charleston in September 1775. So royal government is officially gone, and he takes whatever officials that are still there and haven't been tarred and feathered and what have you.
Right.
But this is one of those great what-ifs. He had been in correspondence with potential loyalists in the backcountry for months before he fled. Instead of fleeing to a British warship and then getting out of Dodge, what if he had fled to the backcountry to rally the king's forces? So we'll never know. That's one of those ifs. It didn't happen.
Right.
I think when you opened up and said, the British made us do it, this is a quotation that Henry Lawrence, and it's a paraphrase, but when the Declaration of Independence came, he said he wept bitter tears. He said he had felt like a son forced out of his father's house. And I think that goes along with your thesis for, it's not the British are coming, the British did it, right?
Yes, Paul Revere didn't say the British are coming, because as of April 18th and 19th, 1775, when he was taking his famous ride along with other fellow riders, he considered himself British. But I really think that the revolution was initiated on the eastern side of the Atlantic in Great Britain rather than in this part of the British Empire. I think that's for sure.
Okay. All right, folks. We are going to fight the revolution next week.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Did you realize that the British really made us do it? That's what Woody Holton would argue, and there's a lot of merit to that argument. It's a very interesting take on why revolution came about between 1770 and 1775. And more importantly, here in South Carolina, it really began earlier than almost any other place. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.